Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. I am Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode, and we have a great one for you today. We're going to talk to a range of fantastic authors. We're going to go back in time a little bit. We're going to get a little bit bloody with some crime and mystery. On today's podcast, we've got Irving Finkel. He's an expert in decoding ancient symbols, and in his latest book, The Ark Before Noah, he reveals a side of that story that you've never heard before. We also have Jack Wolfe, who writes a thrilling and bloody tale about Rawhead and bloody bones. But first up on the podcast, we've got Martina Cole, legendary crime writer, who we got a chance to sit down with here in Edinburgh at one of her recent Blackwell's appearances. She was absolutely fantastic to speak to. Here she is talking about her latest novel, Martina Cole.
Hi, I'm Martina Cole, and I'm here to talk about my new book, The Good Life.
Based on the Tony Bennett song?
Well, I built the book around the song The Good Life because an old friend of mine who'd been in prison for 26 years said that when he dies, he wants The Good Life as his song at his funeral. Because he said, you know, it really, really did summon up the 1960s criminal, you know, the crime world of the 60s. And actually, if you listen to the song, it isn't actually a love song, which people think it is. It's not a nice song. How can I explain it? It says, you know, you may never fall in love, you may never really fall in love. And it's about, you know, kiss the good life goodbye to get back and, you know, get your marriage or your life back. I'd already had the idea of doing a book about a man who was doing a really long, you know, a life prison sentence and how he keeps his life together with his family, his wife, his girlfriend and everyone who's involved with him. So it all just come from there, really.
And this idea of getting into prison life, because you've dealt a lot around these issues, you know, people who have been in prison, people who are about to go to prison. Mm. What is it about these characters and these situations that keeps attracting you, do you think?
I've only written two books from the point of view of the police. That's Lady Killer and Broken, which deals with my female detective, Kate Burrows. In all honesty, I prefer writing from the perspective of the criminal. I think that's a much more bigger canvas, and I think they're much more exciting people to write about. Plus, you can create these huge, great big families as well, you know, and all the, yeah, so many different dynamics to when you're doing a police procedural or you're doing a CSI book. Because I deal with the actual person who's perpetrating the crime. I'm not dealing with clearing it up or trying to solve it. You know in my book who's bad and who's not.
Yeah, and of course, if you're writing from the point of view of the criminal, I think this is the interesting thing. You can't be too judgmental. We have to appreciate and empathize to some degree with this character.
Well, you see, the thing is as well, you know, I grew up in that world as I was growing up, and I can only say, as terrible as this probably sounds, but I only had really good, sort of good experiences from it because, you know, all the people that I dealt with were very good to me. However, I do understand that they might not have been good to everybody, and I do make a point of making that part of the book, you know, that, you know, these are dangerous people, but, you know, they have families and mums and lives and children, and, you know, to an extent, majority of them live a normal life. They just have an extraordinary job. The baddies in my books always get their comeuppance, you know. They're quite moral books in a lot of ways because, you know, the really bad people in my books do get their comeuppance.
Has it changed over time? You've written, I think, 21 books, tell us a bit about that autobiography you did the foreword for.
That was for Eddie Richardson, who's an old friend of mine, and I've known Eddie for years, and I edited the book with him, and I helped him get published. And I'd done the forward because Eddie is the last from the Crays and Richardsons. They're really the last one, Eddie, you know, of that generation of people. At first, he said, I am not going to write my book. I will not write. I think Grass is right book, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, you can set the record straight. And that's why it's called The Last Word. And I mean, I've had some fantastic times with Eddie. He always comes to my launch every year. I mean, he's been very, very good to me. His sister's one of my best friends. And, you know, he turned his life around. He'd done 26 years in prison and he turned his life around. He's now a very, very well-respected painter and he's done a lot with his life against all the odds. And I think that should be applauded. I think anyone who can turn their life around should be applauded. Mm. That's why I do a lot of the prison workshops, to try, especially the younger men who are on huge, huge sentences, you know. If we can get them to read and get them to go into the education and everything else, then, well, my argument is don't send out the same person you put in. Let's try and make them into, you know, a functioning member of society. I'm always shocked by the amount of young men, especially in prisons, who can't read. I think, you know, we've got one of the greatest education systems in the world and it's free. And yet people are still falling under the radar. If you can't fill in a job application, you can't go and get a job.
And I read a couple of interesting things about prisons and you. One is, I think I read that you're like one of the most highly borrowed authors. That's got to be a bestseller list to be proud of.
Requested books in the prison system and the most stolen books from shops, which I'll take as quite a compliment. Funny enough, I was in shop prison this morning and the governor said that your books get stolen out of the library here all the time. But I take that as a compliment.
But also, you know, I think I read somewhere you told because you do creative writing workshops as well, which I've had the opportunity to do, which is brilliant. And you said something really, really wise. And I wonder what the reaction is. You tell them you've got what all writers want, which is time.
Yeah, I always say that. I say you've got the one thing every aspiring author needs is time, and you have the time, you know, to research a book and write your book. I also say I'm probably one of the only people where crime does pay because they've done me a fantastic job. But I think the main thing is I do a thing called the 6-book challenge, which not just in the prisons, but we do it in workplaces and, you know, all over the country. And it's about getting people back reading. Sometimes the last time a person read was at school and they hated reading. You know, because they had to read at school. It's about getting people back, you know, reading for pleasure, really. And I think the reason this works so well in the prisons is because a lot of people never picked a book up in their life till they went to prison. You know, and I think that's really, really sad. And I think it's the greatest, you know, thing you can do is sit down. You can read a book anywhere. I've read a book sitting around Africa, and I was in Africa and I read Out of Africa, you know, Karen Blixen, and I read that around a watering hole when I was waiting for these wild animals to turn up. I've read all around the world, and the one great thing with reading is you can do it anywhere.
And it's one of the only things that makes an airport tolerable.
That's right. And I think also a long prison sentence tolerable. You know, when I was working in one of the prisons in London, Wandsworth, years ago, we'd done these posters and it had escape with a book, which I thought was brilliant because you can escape with a book and you can be anywhere you want to be in the world in a book. You can be on another planet, you can be under the sea, you can be in science fiction, you can be frightened life at yourself, or you can read a good crime novel.
And the 6-book challenge, how does that work, and can anybody get involved and take it up?
You go and you read 6 books or 6 stories or 6 short stories or 6 novels, whatever, and then you get a certificate to say that you completed the 6-book challenge. In the prisons issue, we've got over 40,000 people taking part, which is really fantastic. Yeah,
it's good. And I know there was a big controversy recently about trying to get books out of prison, oddly enough.
I never understood this, you know. I really don't understand this. Such rubbish that you know people can't have books in prison. I think it's just such stupidity. I think that, you know, a book is a basic human right. I think like anything else, you should have access to the written word or text, whatever you want to call it.
And going back, I just wanted to ask, you know, in the 20 some odd years you've been writing novels, the 20 something novels you've written, has your relationship with crime and the underdog and criminals changed it all, as you've maybe left your own life story behind more and gone in and worked more in prisons and these kind of places? Has it affected the writing in some way, or do you feel that it's quite consistent?
I feel it's quite consistent. I don't think I've ever changed. I've still got all the friends I had at school. I've still got every friend I had when I was at school, and they all say the same thing. They say, you've never changed, team, just drive a better car, which I think is a really good compliment. But no, I don't think it's changed at all. Yeah. Crime changes, obviously, all the time. Every 10 years, you have a new influx of different crime. At the moment, it's got a lot of Russian and Eastern European, and of course, I keep up with those times.
How do you do that? How do you keep up to date? Is it just reading, or is it going in, or are you rolling your sleeves up and hanging out in the backs of... You're eating borscht and...
No, I don't. No one would go that far, not even the Russians. But I've got to say, what I normally do is I have a big network of people that I can talk to. And, you know, I'm a big news hound. I read every newspaper and I listen to every news channel. I fall asleep listening to the news. I'm a big news person. And I think it's really like any author. It's just keeping your eyes open and finding out what you want to know.
And are people, when you're doing research and stuff, people who have lived the life, is it the same thing that you get with comedians and authors in general, me as a poet? You got to write a poem about this. You have to write a story. Let me tell you about this one time.
Yeah. Oh, God. The worst one of all is taxi drivers. They always say, you're that Martina Cole. And I go, yeah. And they say, hey, I could tell you some stories. But I remember there's a wonderful story I heard about Maeve Binchy. Maeve Binchy was in a cab in Dublin, and the cab driver said to her, you're that Maeve Binchy, aren't you? And she said, yes, I am. And he said, you've just had that film out, haven't you, The Commitment? And she said, yeah. And he said, I could have written that. She said, yeah, but you didn't, and I did. And I think that's a really fantastic story.
Martina Cole, everybody. You can check her out on her website, martinacole.co.uk. You can get a copy of her book, The Good Life, at fine bookshops anywhere. And of course, you can follow Martina Cole on Twitter, at Martina Cole. And if you're going onto the Twitter to follow Martina, why not follow us at the Scottish Book Trust? That's at Scottish BK Trust. If you don't have a Twitter, do check us out on Facebook. You just click the thumbs up button on our Facebook page at Scottish Book Trust. Or if you want to dip into our resources and our content online, go to our website, www.scottishbooktrust.com. There's always something new and exciting on there. Next up on the podcast is Jack Wolfe. Now, Jack Wolfe has written a novel called The Tale of Rawhead and Bloody Bones, which combines 18th century science and superstition in a really, really thrilling way. It's his debut novel. It was highly acclaimed. Here he is, Jack Wolfe.
I'm Jack Wolfe, hello, and the name of the book is The Tale of Rawhead and Bloody Bones. It's based on a folktale. Rawhead and Bloody Bones, in its original form, is a bogeyman that lives in rivers. It's obviously something that parents have made up to stop the kids from wandering into the river and drowning. So, you know, in the folk myth, he's this horrific, horrible monster that lurks at the bottom of a river. If children go too close, he'll sort of reach out, drag them under, eat them, rip them apart, and over time, actually, although I'm saying he's that for me, he starts out as that, but he develops into slightly different characters in different parts of the country and in slightly different, you know, areas. One of the forms he took later was of a creature that wasn't actually, it was a more standard bogeyman, really, not a creature that was associated with water particularly, but still one that ate children, would sort of tear them limb from limb and then hoard them as a pile of bones.
Rawhead and Bloody Bones, I should say, is we're not retelling the story of Rawhead and Bloody Bones in this novel. What you've done is use that story as part of the background of the character who exists in that time and grew up with that and kind of is still living with the notion of fairy tales and fairies. And it takes place in a very specific time. And I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that very peculiar time it's taking place.
It's taking place in 1750, which is a time where the medieval superstition is on the way out. And modern rationalist thinking is on the way in. You know, 1750 is a time where these two systems of thought coexisted. The peasantry were still very much of a medieval mindset, still believing literally in the existence of fairies, goblins, bogeymen, etc. This belief, incidentally, coexisting with a very sort of naive belief in Christianity. And the intellectual class moving away from that, moving into ideas which foreground rationality, observation, two competing systems, if you like, in existence at the same moment.
And these kind of two competing ideas come together in one incredibly unique character, Tristan Hart. You know, he's a medical student, I guess, wants to be a surgeon. Yeah.
He sees himself as a rational man.
So what is he? How do you describe him without giving too much of the story away, I was wondering?
He's very conflicted. He's a man of two worlds. He reads Descartes, reads Locke, but he also carries an unshakable residual belief in the existence of fairy.
There's a real sensitivity to his character because this conflict between fairies and rationality and, you know, his interest in knowing how things work at a time when it was really hard to figure out how things work, right?
Yes, that's right, yes. First of all, trains himself in the techniques of anatomy, animal dissections where he starts out.
Yeah, if anybody did that today.
Well, yeah.
And this leads to his sort of a state of real madness, I guess, for him. And I think one thing that really propelled me through the novel was understanding his type of madness, which is this sort of like, he understands the world very well.
Yes.
He's really involved in it, and he's very empathetic. And it's that hyper amount of intelligence and his interest in things and his sensitivity, which combine to make him really dubious. And he questions everything that happens
everything
around him.
Yes. Tristan's never sure whether his senses can be believed. He does decide that he can believe his own thoughts, but only just. It's a state in which a lot of people suffering from what is now recognised as, you know, a diagnosable mental condition. Henry Fielding says to Tristan's father that he knows how difficult the world can be for someone of a sensitive disposition. You know, it can be too much for you to deal with. I mean, I think that's probably the case for a lot of people now. You know, we have sensory overload, emotional overload. It's a very difficult world. And I think that a number of people are diagnosed with depression, a very modern illness,
A big feature of the book is Tristan's descent and experimentation with sadism. And I guess that sensitivity, what that began to speak to me about was this notion of pain and sorrow and how that is necessary in life. And that seems to be an extension. He grew up without a mother. His mother died when he was very young. He's obviously very sensitive. And it's a way of exploring his own relationship with pain, I guess, in some way, and with sorrow, and how it can be necessary.
Pain is real, isn't it? You know, the people of Tristan's time, Mrs. H, for instance, I mean, she believes fairies are real. Pain is also sort of, it's real emotionally, psychologically. It's something that we can't argue away. He realises that pain is the one feeling that can, if you like, leap from one person to another. His understanding of sadism is that by creating a physical sensation in another person, he has, I suppose, touched a part of them, a part of their soul almost, a part of their heart that is otherwise inaccessible. It's the pain is the, to Tristan, the one thing between himself and another living being that can, I suppose, in a way, can't be corrupted.
And I guess in a way, a lot of his pain, his own personal pain and sorrow, is mental, right? And it doesn't have a physical existence until he puts it on somebody else. He believes he's evil and he believes he's a monster. You know, that's something that, like, he internalizes.
Yes,
I think that's totally contemporary as well.
Yeah.
If you look at anybody who is experiencing anything outside the norm. Have you had feedback from people who are squeamish? I mean, we should say to the listeners, there is some serious blood going on.
Yeah, there's blood and gore in this novel, yeah. People have read the operation scene and turned white, nearly fainted.
You can get through it. I mean, I totally got through it. There were definitely moments where I had to stop and take a breath. The voice is so powerful in the book, and you, that was a really conscious decision you had to choose to make, because it's written in a very archaic language.
Yeah, the whole sort of flow of the language is contemporary with the date of the novel. If you like, the assumptions that drive it are as close as I could get them to someone of that period. You know, I've read a lot of 18th century literature, so the rhythm was, when I finally came to actually writing it, was instinctive.
Yeah, and how hard must it be to, like, just cut off a part of your brain, basically, and be like, I can't use these words, I can't, these theories, yeah.
That is exactly what you have to do. Well, I guess what you're doing is you're getting into character, you're method acting, and you have to get into the character of someone in 1750 who doesn't know half of what you do, less than half, but who also knows a lot of things that you don't, you know. I mean, Tristan is able to read fluent Latin. I can't. Men of that period, educated men, and Tristan sees himself as an educated man, peppered their conversation with Latin and Greek quotes. And actually, they weren't showing off their knowledge. It's just what you did. And in that sense, actually, the language is probably toned down. It's less accurate than it could have been. But I think, you know, if I'd peppered it with Latin and Greek quotes, the modern reader would have really been turned off by that. I know while I was writing it, I had this little voice in the back of my head the whole time saying, you can't use that, you can't use that, you can't use that, you can't use that. You've got to use this, you've got to rely on this bit. This is how he would say it, you know. But that sort of mechanism becomes so automatic that you cease to notice it. And you just write, and it becomes as instinctive as speaking the language I speak now.
Could you switch easily? Could you describe the scene right now?
I was extremely drunk one night while I was writing the first draft, and I began speaking in Georgian English, and I couldn't stop. It became hugely embarrassing, and that's very hard when you're extremely drunk. I'd kind of somehow flipped from the normal speaking voice and personality, if you like, that I am now, you know, to the voice that I had in my head while I was writing.
It's like a case of linguistic hiccups.
You know, I guess that's just kind of how my brain obviously works. You know, I have a compartment, if you like, for that sort of language, and it got activated at the wrong moment.
Jack Wolfe, everybody. His novel is The Tale of Rawhead and Bloody Bones, and if you're not squeamish, it is a highly recommended read. Now, book lovers across Scotland, get your calendars out, because it is coming up to Book Week Scotland time, our favorite time of year. Book Week Scotland, for those who don't know, is a week-long celebration of books and reading that takes place every November. This year, it will be taking place from Monday the 24th of November to Sunday the 30th. During Book Week Scotland, people of all ages and walks of life come together in libraries, schools, community venues, and workplaces to share and enjoy books and reading. It's an absolute joy to see so many people talking about books and books being such a prevalent thing during that week. So there's loads of events happening as part of Book Week Scotland. Check your local libraries, check your schools, check our website, www.scottishbooktrust.com, for ways that you can get involved online or in your area. We have a Twitter account dedicated to the whole Book Week Scotland extravaganza. You can follow us at Book Week Scott. Also, we've got a Facebook page you can follow us on. All you have to do is search for Book Week Scotland on Facebook, click on the thumbs up like button, and you'll find out all about our activities and events that are happening throughout Scotland. Last up on the podcast, we're going to go way, way back in time, not just to the 18th century. No, that was practically yesterday for Irving Finkel. We're going back to ancient Mesopotamia. We're talking BC, ladies and gentlemen. If you think you know the story of Noah's Ark, truth is, you might not, because even Irving Finkel, legendary expert and Assyriologist, didn't know the story of Noah's Ark as completely as he's about to explain to you before writing The Ark Before Noah, decoding the story of the flood. Turns out the story of Noah's Ark has been around for a long time, even before the Bible.
My name is Irving Finkel, and I'm a curator in the British Museum in London, and I've just written a book called The Ark Before Noah, Decoding the Story of the Flood. Well, the thing is, I'm a curator, and one of the things that curators have to do is not only work on things in the collection, but look at things that people bring, outsiders bring, for examination. And a few years ago, a chap called Douglas Simmons came in one afternoon with a few bits and pieces of antiquity, and one of them was this cuneiform tablet. And it fell to me to examine it first, and I picked it up, and I thought it was going to be a letter. You know, it's written in about 1850 BC, 1800 BC, that kind of period, but it looks like a letter. So I picked it up thinking, oh, this is going to be just a mundane sort of thing, and read the first few lines and realised straight away that it was the beginning of an important part of the flood story. Now, you know, the thing is, the flood story in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, everybody knows this with the ark and the flood and Noah and all that. It's a kind of universally known narrative. And what people don't know so much is that the ancient Mesopotamians who lived in what is now Iraq, the Babylonians, the Sumerians, they also had this story about 1,000 years before the Bible came into being. And this was a new piece of that Babylonian version. And it was electrifying because as I deciphered it, I discovered this, which was something completely unanticipated. In the narrative, the god, whose name is Enki, decides he will warn the equivalent of our Noah, who is called Atram Chassis. He's the Babylonian Noah character, that he had to destroy his house and build a boat and rescue life because a deluge was going to destroy all the life on the globe. And we knew this already. It was a similar thing to the Bible. But what was amazing in this tablet was the god told him the shape of the boat, how big it was, what he needed to use to build it, all the specifications as if you were going to do it now.
I think one of the things was enough rope that it would stretch from Edinburgh to London. Well, I mean, huge amounts of...
Yes, it's a very convenient figure. London to Edinburgh is the distance that the rope that they were going to use would cover. Now, the thing is, the most important thing is, the rope was used to build a boat which was round. Now, you know what Noah's Ark looks like. You probably had one when you were a boy, a kind of watermelon thing with a little house in the middle and a ladder and a giraffe looking out the window and all that kind of thing. Well, this is what people kind of imagine Noah's Ark to look like. Or, of course, there's a description in the Bible, which is a bit more serious. It's a kind of oblong craft. But nobody, I don't think, ever had the idea that this boat might be round. So when I was first working on this tablet, I'm sitting in the museum scratching my head. You know, what the hell is this? What is a round boat can be? And then, of course, I remembered that there are round boats by the rivers in the modern world called coracles, very simple craft, which you find by the rivers in Wales and Scotland and Ireland, and also in Tibet and India, in many parts of the world. This is a natural kind of craft that grows up in riverine communities. And, of course, the ancient Babylonians also had these round craft. And so once you twigged that this was what the ark was going to be like, it made a lot of sense, because these coracles, they're simple craft. They're made like a kind of basket, and then they're coated with bitumen on the inside and outside, so they're highly waterproof. And the thing is, they never sink. And when you start to think about the flood story, you always imagine it's a boat that is going to go from A to B, like on a voyage, but it isn't. All it has to do is to float on top of the water, bob around with all the animals inside until the water goes down, then it goes all the way down again, bomb, lands on the mountain. So you don't need a craft that will go anywhere, you just need a craft that will float. And this poet, that was his understanding. He thought to himself, you know, if this story happened, what kind of boat would it be? It must be one of these, but the biggest one in the world, not like a normal two-seater, which you find on the Euphrates River, but the biggest one you ever saw. So let's look at this thing. This is an exact copy made in the British Museum of the tablet which I published. So that we have a brilliant craftsman who can do this. He made a mould of it and then cast it in resin, but it looks exactly like the original. So if you've never seen one of these things, if you want to visualise it, it fits in the hand like a mobile phone. And it's made of clay, and the writing is in neat lines from left to right across the tablet, and it goes all the way down the one side and then all the way down the other. And the writing is impressed into the surface, leaving these kind of marks. People think they were made by drunk chickens. It's rather a helpful analogy. And this kind of writing, called cuneiform writing, is the oldest writing that archaeology has brought to light, but it's been deciphered since the 19th century, and we can read it. And the language, which is clothed in this funny writing, which is quite bizarre when you first look at it, is ancient Babylonian, which is related to some modern languages which are still alive, like Arabic or Hebrew, the Semitic family. This ancient Babylonian language was a cousin of these modern languages. So when it was first deciphered, they had a good idea of how it might be, you know, because they knew Semitic languages in general. And there's something else I have to tell you, apart from all the measurements. On the back it says, in the bit where all the animals are loaded onto the boat, it says that the animals went on two by two, like it does in the Bible. And that's an astonishing thing, because we've never had that before in all our sources from Mesopotamia, but the expression two by two is there on this tablet. It means that the very ancient story which existed in Iraq is close indeed to the one which we have in the Bible. In fact, the similarities are so great that it seems very probable that the narrative embedded in Genesis, which is the one that underpins Christianity and Islam and Judaism, all three, the central story of those religions, derives closely from a version of the story which existed long before in ancient Iraq.
Was it always so potent, do you think?
I think it was potent, but in different ways. In the Babylonian story, because this tablet which came to me, which I published, is only part of a much bigger story in itself. The whole story of the flood is part of a whole thing about the world and the gods and everything. And in that story, we are told that the gods decide to destroy the human race, especially because they made so much racket, they were so noisy, and the main gods were fed up. You know, they were sitting there in their deck chairs after lunch, and there's all this brouhaha, and one of them says, look, we're going to get rid of this stuff, we're going to invent something new which does all the work but doesn't make any noise. So theologically, the Babylonians had this conception that it was for that reason that there was destruction, but at the last minute there was a let out and one of the gods leaked the information and the boat was built. When you encounter the story in the Bible, it's a very different kettle of fish, because according to the Judean philosophy, God decided to obliterate mankind because they were sinful and they were wicked. At the last minute, God, as it were, relented and instructed Noah to build the ark. So the balance of, as it were, naughty behaviour and punishment was much more black and white and familiar to us, that wickedness and sin gets brutally punished, than the Babylonian thing, which was something that seemed a bit comic to us even, that could have really been the prevailing matter. So the way I see it is that in the writing of the Bible, this story of, which you can readily conceive to be a sort of Hollywood narrative where the world's going to be destroyed at any minute, and one guy, one Bruce Willis kind of person, is going to rescue everything, you know, before the end of the episode kind of idea, in antiquity had a similar power to what it does today. And I think that the Judeans, who, as I see it, when they were in Babylon after the destruction of Jerusalem, they were taken into captivity under Nebuchadnezzar II in the beginning of the 6th century. So they were in Babylonia. They lived there for three generations, as we are told in the Bible, and in the course of it, they became familiar with many of the aspects of Babylonian culture, and I think some of them learned to read and write, and Babylonian, that's to say, and I think the consequence was that this story, which was an old Babylonian tradition, seemed to them of great instructive literary power, that it taught how vulnerable man was in the face of nature plus divinity, that it was for their own purposes valid. And at the outset of the world, as described in Genesis, you have this scenario that God decides that the human race is so wicked and so sinful and altogether naughty that this also was a mistake, and he would destroy everything vengefully. And there was the let out at the last minute when they had an escape. So I see the principal system that the Babylonian story ended up in the Bible at the time when the Judeans were in Babylonia and became familiar with it. But in the process of it, the underlying philosophical value of the story was altogether different, altogether more sophisticated. The links between the stories are so strong that it is a matter of literature. So, for example, in the Bible, as you know, Noah opened a window and he released on three separate occasions a bird, and the first time it came back and the second time it did and the third time it didn't, so he knew that the waters had gone down sufficiently, that there were trees above the waterline and this bird didn't come home. So this is in the Bible, but it's also in the Babylonian version. And when you look at them side by side, you cannot rationally escape the conclusion that there's a strong literary link, a borrowing between them. It's not enough to say they had the same sort of story for generations, because if, for example, there was a very ancient story like this all round the Middle Eastern world, and so it survived here and it survived there, the end results would be widely different, right? For example, this Chinese whispers game, you know what happens, you have a cue and something at one end comes out the other, it's totally unrecognisable. You would never have things which were exactly matching. But the Hebrew text and the Babylonian text are, anybody who thinks in a literary sense, undoubtedly a matter of borrowing one to the other.
Yeah, it's like finding it was the best of times, it was the worst of times on a scroll from 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, it's compelling, it's compelling, exactly so.
Irving Finkel, everybody. The book is The Ark Before Noah, Decoding the Story of the Flood. Thanks to him for sitting down and making the time to talk to us. If you like that interview and you want to find out more about Irving Finkel, we featured him on a recent episode of the Multicolored Culture Laser. We sat down with him at his offices at the British Museum, and we worked on a tablet together. Well, I didn't do so much. But yeah, thanks to him. Thanks to Jack Wolf. Thanks to Martina Cole. And thanks to you for listening. We hope to see you very soon at Book Week Scotland, 24th to the 30th of November. Loads of events. We'll be at a few of them. We hope you will be too. Until then, take your earbuds out and get lost in a good book.